Here in Hebrews 6, I asked Larry to read, starting in verse 9 there. And the theme of this lesson is going to be hope for the hopeless. And you'll notice that the word hope is mentioned several times along that reading. And you think about Hebrews chapter 6, and the first verses of Hebrews chapter 6, the first 8 verses, are some of the most controversial in the Bible. They present problems for many groups, Calvinists certainly, but also for non-Calvinists. Like, what exactly is it saying? We're not going to get into that. That's a whole different thing. But it's quite negative. Verse 8, "But if it yields thorns and thistles, it is worthless and close to being cursed, and it ends up being burned. However, I don't want everything to be negative," the writer says. "But beloved, we are convinced of better things concerning you." So all this negativity, all these warnings, all these admonitions, I want you to know we're convinced of something better for you. "And things that accompany salvation, though we speak in this way," what way? The negative way he's been speaking. "For God is not unjust so as to forget your work and the love which you have shown toward his name and having ministered and is still ministering to the saints. And we desire that each one of you show the same diligence so as to realize the full assurance of hope until the end." You think about hope. How important is hope? What does hope do? It's a good question. What does hope do? And some would say, well, hope is, some have the idea of hope is, that's just some illusion that you people, you Christians, or you religious people, any religious group has put before them so that they can get through the drudgery of each day. It's not based on anything. It's not real. But you need a little help getting through life, so you turn to these fairy tales so that you can get by with your miserable lives. That's the hope you set before yourselves. There's no basis for your faith. There's no evidence for your faith. You can't put it into an equation and say the probability of it happening is X. It's just hopium. Hopium. It's like asking somebody who's just started a business, well, do you think your business is going to succeed? And they say, of course. I have absolute hope that it's going to succeed. And you ask them, okay, well, does your product have any problems? Oh, yeah, tons of problems. We get them back all the time. What about the people you hired? Oh, they're incompetent. Some of the most incompetent people I've ever met. What about the macroeconomic status? Oh, it's horrible. Well, why do you have hope? It feels better than not having hope. And that's how people view us when we say, I have hope that I'm going to be resurrected from the dead. They say, that sounds It sounds ridiculous. Show me somebody that's been resurrected from the dead. Go ahead, show me, I'll wait. Show me. You're hoping, but it's based on nothing. That's how people view this. That's how the majority of the world views this. "So that you will not be sluggish, but imitators of those who through faith..." What's required here? It's faith. Now, faith, what is faith? Confidence. I have confidence. Is that based on anything? Yes, it better be based on something. It's not bragging to say, oh, my faith is based on nothing. My hope is based on nothing. My hope is built on nothing less than my imagination. No, that's not a brag. That's something you should say to your shame. We have evidence. Now, you can take the evidence, you can accept it, or you can deny it. But we have evidence. And based on that evidence, it leads me to believe that my faith is sure. And based on that, I do go through the drudgery of each day, looking toward that light at the end of the tunnel. Now, some people would say, well, that light sometimes is a train. Absolutely, sometimes it's a train. There are Muslims who have hope as well. I think for them, that light's going to be a train. Okay, the question is that true for me? And for that, I have to examine the evidence to see, are these things really true? Is my hope based on something that is worth having confidence in, or is it just me making stuff up? Okay, verse 13, for when God made the promise to Abraham, since he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself. Do you see the significance there? What should our hope be based on? Well, one, that God said it's true. Now, you could say, well, I don't believe God actually said that, but let's take it that you actually believe that. God said it was true. Okay, you'd say that's quite enough for anybody. But God went a step further. And he says, not only am I going to say it's true, I'm going to swear. Now, what's the problem with that? When you swear by something greater than yourself. You swear because people view you as untrustworthy. I need to swear on the temple. I need to swear on God. I need to swear on my parents. I need to swear on something that people will take me seriously with. So, being God, what's the problem with that? Well, there's no one greater. There's no one greater. So God has a problem here. What's he do? For when God made the promise to Abraham, since he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself. There is no one greater, so I have to swear by myself. That's the only option. Saying, and he's assuming that you know Genesis here, in the context, God does swear. But he doesn't quote it here. Saying, I will surely bless you and I will surely multiply you. And so having patiently waited, what's the key here? You guys say you have hope and that it's not hopium, like we say it is, but it's based on facts and evidence. Yet, I don't see anything. I'm not seeing any fruit there. You guys get sick. You guys get fired. You guys have all the problems that we have, and you just keep going. Like, where's the proof? Where's the evidence? And so, having patiently waited, is there any need for patience? Is there any need for waiting on the Lord? Absolutely. He obtained the promise after having patiently waited. For men swear by one greater than themselves, and with them an oath is given as confirmation. It is an end of every dispute. An oath was seen, or a swearing by something was seen as a contract. We're entering into this contract. I'm very serious about this. If somebody does that, to violate it would be something that would basically end their life in the public. No one would take them seriously afterwards. In the same way, God desiring even more to show to the heirs of the promise the unchangeableness of his purpose, the immutability of his purpose, interposed with an oath. So I'm so set on showing you that I am not going to let you down, that I'm going to swear by myself, and I'm going to interpose, I'm going to put in this oath so that you will have confidence. Confidence that what I say is the truth, and that you can depend on it, and that you can direct your life in a way that seems counterproductive at times, but at the end, there will be a reward. Verse 18, so that by two unchangeable things, God said it and God swore by an oath, in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have taken refuge would have strong encouragement. Think about that. We who have taken refuge. So I'm out here in this forsaken world, and there are so many paths to go down, so many problems, so many temptations, so many things that threaten me constantly. And what do? I take refuge under the wings of God. I go to him for refuge, for protection. And everyone around me is saying what? They're saying basically what they said to Jesus. He trusts in God. Let him save him. I see you got ill again. I see you got a terminal illness there. Well, you trust in God. Let him save him then. What do you say to that? We who have taken refuge would have strong encouragement to take hold of the hope set before us. There's a hope set before us in face of all the difficulties, in face of all the infirmities, in face of all the temptations, in face of all that threatens us in this world. We have a hope set before us, but we have to take hold. There's something for us to do. This hope we have as an anchor of the soul. What's an anchor do? An anchor, just in kindergarten terms, keeps something steady. It keeps something locked in one position without wavering, without going from side to side. But what else is important about that? Of course, it's important not to be tossed around. But it also depends where you are. There are some places that you don't want to be anchored. I'm driving through certain parts of town. I really hope my car doesn't break down in those parts of town. I don't want to be anchored there. I'm going through certain parts of the world. I hope I don't get stranded in this part of the world. I don't want to be anchored there. There are better places to be anchored than others. Where are we anchored? A hope both sure and steadfast, and one which enters within the veil. What's he talking about? In the presence of God. We are anchored in the presence of God. We've already got the first fruits. You want some proof? You want some evidence? The first fruits have already risen. And he is in the presence of God. And that is our anchor that is holding us in the presence of God, where Jesus has entered as a forerunner for us. Forerunner. Going before. Running before us. The idea is we'll come after. Having become a high priest, the intermediary, forever according to the order of Melchizedek. Now, we're not going to get into that. That's a whole different thing. But hope is so important. Because what happens? You know, you could think of a very simple example. You could think of standing in line for food or being in line at a restaurant for food. And if it becomes apparent after about 15 minutes that the line isn't moving, what do you start thinking? Is this really worth it? Is this really worth it? You know, that other restaurant's right down the street. Is this really worth it? And then 15 more minutes pass. I don't think it's worth it. And then you start calculating, well, I've already spent 30 minutes. I might as well just keep waiting. That's a sunken cost fallacy. That's a logical fallacy, but that's a different call it. But you start thinking, is this worth it? All the things I'm suffering, all the things I'm facing, is the prize, is the end of the way worth the journey? Let's turn over to Mark chapter 5. Mark chapter 5. And we're going to see something brought out in two illustrations that teaches us something about when hope really arises. And often hope arises when things look as dark as they can. When things are as bad as possible, that is when you tend to take hold of that hope set before you. That's when you tend, now people would say, well, that's just because you're desperate. That's just because you're desperate. And there's some truth to that. Sometimes you have to hit rock bottom. Sometimes you have to hit that nadir, that lowest point, before you look around and reevaluate things and say, okay, what here is really important? What here is really the thing I should be focusing on? We're in Mark chapter 5. Mark chapter 5, and we're going to, well, I'll just talk about what was happening in Mark chapter 5 before we start reading here. You'll remember that the chapter starts with Jesus healing this man with a demon, and very famously, the demon says, "We are legion. We are legion. There are many of us. There's a legion of us in this man," and this man was doing all kinds of things. And then Jesus lets the demons go out into the pigs. The pigs run off a cliff. And what do the people do after that? Do you remember that? They say, "Jesus, please." In fact, let's just start reading verse 14. "The herdsmen ran away and reported in the city and the country, and the people came to see what it was that had happened. They came to Jesus and observed the man who had been demon-possessed sitting down, clothed, and in his right mind." And the very man who had the legion, and they became frightened. What happens when you come up and you see this kind of power? Well, we're going to see several reactions, but one reaction quite logical, is to say, I'm scared. Because this kind of power can be used for you or it can be used against you. How do you know which one is going to occur? Well, you don't, because you don't have any control over it. Obviously, you don't have any control over this kind of power. So we're frightened, and what do they say? Verse 16 of Mark chapter 5, those who had seen it described to them how it had happened to the demon-possessed man and all about the swine. And they began to implore him, "We beg you, please leave." They began to implore him to leave the region, and he was getting into the boat. The man who had been demon-possessed was imploring him that he might accompany him, and he did not let him. But he said to him, "Go home to your people and report to them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he had mercy on you." And he went away and began to proclaim in Decapolis, the 10 cities, what great things Jesus had done for him, and everyone was amazed. So the people say, "Please leave." The man who had the miracle done to him said, "Please let me go with you." Jesus says, "No, but you do have a job. Your job is to go spread the word." Okay. Now, so Jesus has been asked politely, I suppose, implored to leave. We don't want anything to do with this power. We don't know where it's from. We don't know what it can do. We don't know if it's against us, for us. We just want you to leave. We're frightened. So he does. You ask Jesus to leave, and he will. "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If you come to the door and open it, I'll come in and sup. But if you don't, I'm not going to force my way in." Okay? What happens on the other side? So he gets in the boat. He crosses the sea. He's going to the other side. When Jesus had crossed over again in the boat to the other side, a large crowd gathered around him, and so he stayed by the seashore. Now, do you see what's going on in this verse? He crosses to the other side, and what's waiting for him? A large crowd. And notice the word, "and so he stayed by the seashore." This crowd is so large, this crowd is so imposing, that I've got to stay in my spot here. I can't go through this crowd. This crowd is someone who we're going to see, an entity who we'll see is going to throng him, is going to threaten to crush him. One of the synagogue officials, you think about hope. We read this story, and if you have a daughter, if you have a son, if you have anybody that is important to you, and they're on the verge of death, they're at the extreme, they're about to die at the point of death, to such point that the mourners are already there. When Jesus finally arrives, we all know the story, when Jesus finally arrives, the mourners are already there. And they're mourning, they're wailing. They knew that death was imminent for this little girl. If you're a man, and you have that daughter, and you hear, "Well, Jesus was rejected on the other side, but he just arrived. And a crowd is there at the sea." What's that going to do to you? Well, one, it's going to fill you with that last bit of hope. Perhaps there's still a sliver of hope left. Now, certainly, if this girl had been sick for any amount of time, he would have gone to all the doctors he could. He would have done anything that was necessary to heal his daughter. That's just natural. We're going to see there's still one thing available to him. One of the synagogue officials named Jairus came up and, on seeing him, fell at his feet. And you might say, "Jairus, have some dignity. Have some respect for yourself. You don't go up and fall at the feet of another man. You're an official of the synagogue. Don't you know this guy's a heretic? Don't you know he works on the Sabbath? Don't you know he does X, Y, and Z? Don't you know this is going to get you excommunicated from the synagogue? This is going to cause all kinds of trouble?" But what situations like this do is they reorder your values. There's only one thing that is important to Jairus at this point, and it's his daughter. It reminds me of what Paul says. He says, "All the things that I counted as gain, I now count as rubbish. They're of no worth to me now. My position as the ruler of the synagogue, my power, my authority, all those things, worthless. In face of what? The death of my daughter. Nothing is going to get in the way of me going to Jesus. You think of the famous saying, a horse, my kingdom for a horse. A king in battle, about to be killed. I need an escape route. I'll give anybody who can give me a horse my whole kingdom. Why? Because my kingdom is worth nothing without my life. My power, my position, my money, everything worthless in face of losing my daughter. So he's willing to humble himself. He's willing to do whatever it takes to hold on to the hope that is set before him. Verse 23, and implored him earnestly, saying, my little daughter is at the point of death, at the border, at the extreme. And we'll see he's not exaggerating at all. By the time Jesus gets there, she is dead. My little daughter is at the point of death. Please come and lay your hands on her so that she will get well and live. What did Jairus heard of all the other miracles that Jesus had done? And you can only imagine what was going through Jairus' mind. We can only imagine what was going through Jairus' mind when they say, he's at the seashore, and she's not dead yet. And he went off with him, verse 24, and he went off with him, and a large crowd was following and pressing in on him. Now, this isn't me walking through, you know, the mall. It's kind of crowded. But I've got room to breathe, room to move. Nobody's really touching me. If somebody touches me, it's kind of a faux pas. No, people are grabbing on him. People are touching him. Why? Because everyone else knows as well, if I touch this guy, if I touch this Jesus, if I even touch the hem of his garment, perhaps I'll be healed. So I'm going to take my chances. And he went off with him, and a large crowd was following him and pressing in on him. This would be, you know, in most situations, something that was, well, first of all, it would certainly be uncomfortable. It would be annoying. It would be dangerous. Big crowds like that are dangerous. It's very easy to die in a crowd like that. And he went, verse 25, and a woman who had a hemorrhage for 12 years and had endured much at the hands of many physicians and had spent all that she had was not helped at all, but rather had grown worse. Talk about someone in need of hope. For 12 years, I've had this issue. Now, this issue isn't going to lead to her death that we know of, but it's something that has been weighing her down for 12 years, and what has she done about it? It's not like she said, well, I'm just going to suffer. You know, it's no big deal. No, I've been doing everything I could. I've been spending every dime I have to go to the physicians, and guess what? They can't help me. They can't help me, and I've lost hope, but just like Jairus, I heard that this Jesus, this miracle worker, had come to our shore. So I, too, am going to go to him, and he, too, represents my hope. So she had not been helped, but rather had grown worse. So the physicians, the ones whom she had gone to, with the hope of them helping her, had actually made her worse. After hearing about Jesus, verse 27, she came up in the crowd, being behind him, and touched his cloak. So this mob around him, certainly clinging on to him, pressing in on him, she comes up, she manages to weave her way in there and to touch the hem of his garment, to touch his cloak. For she thought, why'd she do that? Wouldn't she have to talk to him? Wouldn't he have to lay hands on her or something like that? Wouldn't he have to say something? For she thought, if I just touch his garment, I will get well. I've been disappointed throughout the last 12 years with doctor after doctor. All my money is gone, but all I have to do is touch this man without him even knowing, and I don't want him to know, because who knows what all the reasons are, but one reason would be because she's unclean. The blood makes her unclean, ceremonially unclean. And if she makes Jesus unclean, that's going to be a big problem, a big inconvenience for him. But if he doesn't know, no harm, no foul. It wouldn't be his fault. For she thought, if I just touch his garment, I will get well immediately. Notice that. Immediately, one of Mark's favorite words. He uses it in all kinds of situations. Immediately, the flow of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she had been healed of her affliction. Her hope was not a disappointing hope. It did not lead her into disappointment. It wasn't like the hope of the doctors. It wasn't like all the hopes that she had before for those 12 years. This hope led to something that actually had power behind it, that actually had evidence behind it. Her hope was rewarded. Of course, that's what we want as well. We want our hope to be rewarded, and for that we keep going on until the end. But she felt in her body that this was healed immediately. But there's also something else that happened. Immediately, Jesus perceiving in himself the power proceeding from him, which is, you know, an interesting phrase and interesting what exactly happened, and, we don't really know. I'm not going to blabber on about something I have no idea about. But all I can say is what it says, perceiving in himself that the power proceeding from him had gone forth, turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And this disciple said to him, what's the obvious thing to say? Now remember, this isn't me walking through Opry Mills or something, where if somebody touches me, I kind of give them a dirty look. This is people grabbing on him. It's like the Beatles coming to town. People grabbing, people touching, hoping to be healed. And the obvious question is, what are you talking about? Who touched me? Don't you see all these people touching you? Which one of the thousand people that have touched you do you want us to say? Which one? And his disciple said to him, you see the crowd pressing in on you and you say, who touched me? What a ridiculous thing to say. And he looked around to see the woman who had done this, but the woman, fearing and trembling, aware of what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction. Now, it's interesting that if you were Jairus and you were going along on this ride, what would you be thinking? No, 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 no. Why are you stopping? You know, in a hospital, there's a triage. It's just common sense. It's the same thing as ordering your life and the things most important. If somebody comes in with a headache, that's going to be farther down the list than somebody comes in with, a cut to their neck. Their jugular's been hit. One could lead to imminent death. The other can wait. And if you're Jairus, everything and anything at this point can wait. He doesn't know this woman's story. He doesn't know anything about this woman, but it can wait. Trust me, it can wait. My daughter is about to die. She's at death's doorstep. But Jesus sees it from a different perspective. Yes, his daughter is about to die, and yes, she does die on the way. However, let me ask you this. What led Jairus to have such affection for the one he came to ask Jesus to heal? Why did he have such affection for this person? Well, it's only natural. It's his daughter. It's his daughter. Of course he's going to have affection. Of course he'll do whatever it takes to help her. Of course he's going to do that. That's his obligation. That's his duty. But look what Jesus says to this woman. Jairus, don't think that you're the only person that has somebody important to you. This woman is just as important to me as your daughter is to you and as your daughter is to me. She's of equal importance. He said to her, daughter, I look at this woman just as you look at your daughter. Daughter, your faith has made you well. Why does he say that? What did she believe? She believed, if I only touch the hem of his garment, I'm going to be healed. Your faith has made you well. Now notice she had to believe that and actually do it. There are two things involved there. faith and works. Faith is dead without the works. She wasn't healed before she did it. But daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace, and you will be healed and be healed of your affliction. Okay, so that's a that's a kind of a strange interlude there, but it's a story of a woman who had lost all hope, who had seen a spark of hope at the end of the road, and had been, after being deceived and disappointed for so many years, finally found something worth hoping in. Someone worth hoping in. Okay, well, what about Jairus? Going back to him. And you can imagine what he's thinking seeing all this. First of all, he's probably doing everything he can to clear away. Get out of the way. The sirens are going off. He's yelling. He's trying to get everyone out of the way. Because my daughter is on the line. Verse 35, while Jesus was saying, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." While he was still speaking, they came from the house of the synagogue official saying, "Oh no, hope has been lost. Hope has been lost. Your daughter has died. Why trouble the teacher anymore?" Your daughter's dead. You had one last chance. You had some hope. You had that ray of hope on the horizon. But guess what? It's too late. Too much time. The crowd got in the way. This woman got in your way. She took you. She cut in line there. And your daughter is the victim. Your daughter has died. Why trouble the teacher anymore? Don't you see what a trouble it is to go through this crowd? Don't take any more of his time. Don't make him do this. But Jesus, verse 36, but Jesus, overhearing what was being spoken, said to the synagogue official, "Do not be afraid any longer. Only believe." Why do you lose hope so easily? O ye of little faith, why do you lose hope so easily? Do not be afraid any longer. And what happens when you lose hope? What comes in to take its place? All kinds of fears, all kinds of doubts, all kinds of forces that are threatening to push you from here to there. The anchor of your soul has been pulled up to the bolt, and now you're just moving all around. But he says, be steady. Jesus, overhearing what was being spoken, said to the synagogue official, "Do not be afraid any longer. Only believe. Your hope has not vanished." But you say, well, certainly, I believe that you have power to heal her, but certainly everybody has limits, don't they? That is to say, there are certain situations where hope is just not appropriate. And some people will look at their own situation and say, it's hopeless for me. It's hopeless for me. Maybe for somebody else, there's hope. But for me, I'm hopeless. What I've done, it's hopeless. What I've said, it's hopeless. What my personality is hopeless. No. Do not be afraid any longer. Only believe. What is your duty? Cast out the fear. Cast out the anxiety and believe. Trust in him in whom your hope is anchored. And he allowed no, at this point, apparently all his disciples were following him, but what's he say at this point? No one more except three. Peter, James, and John, often called the inner circle. Whenever something of great import is happening, it's usually these three. The Mount of Transfiguration, this instance, various other instances, it's these three. So everybody else has to stay out. Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, you three come with me. And he came to the house of the synagogue official, and he saw a commotion and people loudly weeping and wailing. Notice that they're already there. They're already weeping and wailing. They knew that this young girl was at the point of death. And people will mention these are probably professional wailers. These are people that they hire to cry and to wail at somebody's death. And even for homeless people or for, you know, people of ill repute, they say they had to have at least two of these guys here. Whether that's true or not, we certainly don't have any proof, but it's probably true. But either way, they're there and they're wailing, they're weeping, they're making these loud lamentations, and one of the reasons they did that so that the family could cry as much as they want to without making too much of a scene. These people would draw the attention away from the weeping family. They would make an even bigger scene. And entering into the house, he said to them, "Why make a commotion and weep? The child has not died, but is asleep." And here we have the same thing that people will say to us. What a simpleton you are. What a simpleton. You say you have this hope that's anchored in heaven. You have no proof. Show me. What is the proof? Show me in a lab. Show me mathematically. Show me. Somehow show me. No proof at all. Do a miracle. Go ahead. Do a miracle. Okay. I'll wait. It's not going to happen. And they say, what a simpleton. You just believe anything. You know, you make fun of other people for believing in, you know, unicorns or whatever, but you believe in talking snakes. You make fun of other people for believing in healing stones, but you believe in all this other stuff, all these other fairy tales. What a simpleton. You have no reason to have hope. You have no reason to have faith. It's based on nothing except to make yourself feel good. Because you're scared of the dark. But guess what? You just got to accept reality as it is. That's what people will say, certainly. That's the overwhelming sentiment. Why make a commotion and weep? The child has not died but is asleep. Now these people, what are they going to say to Jesus? This guy, this is your savior? This is the guy you went to? This is the guy you put your hope in? He can't even tell that she's dead. And they began laughing at him. But putting them all out, he took along the child's father and mother and his own companions and entered the room where the child was. Now here's where the rubber hits the road. As I said, just because you hope in something doesn't mean it's true. The Muslims hope in all kinds of things. The Jews hope in all kinds of things. The Hindus hope in all kinds of things. Everyone hopes. The atheists hope there is no God. Does that mean it's true? Absolutely not. Is there any evidence? That's the question. Is there any power? Is it actually true? That's the question. If it is true, then your hope is valid. If it's not true, no matter how long I'm up here and babbling on, it means nothing. They're just empty words. Taking the child by the hand, so let's see. Taking the child by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kum," which translated means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Now think about watching this. This little girl is certainly dead. She's dead. And it's interesting that he says that she's asleep. Now, was she dead or was she asleep? Well, there's a connection here with what Paul says as well. And throughout the whole New Testament, the dead are called to be sleeping. And we could get into doctrines like soul sleep and all that kind of stuff. But it's a very simple thing to explain. Death is not a permanent state. It is a temporary state. Yes, she's sleeping. It's temporary. It's not permanent. I'm going to wake her up. And let me prove it to you. Well, it's easy to say, but let's see the proof. Taking the child by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kum." Now, it also happens that probably all this happened in Aramaic. They're probably all talking Aramaic. Most of it's translated to Greek. Everything except this is translated to Greek. For some reason, they leave this part in Aramaic. Maybe because the words are so impactful that you need to hear exactly how it sounded. "Talitha kum," which translated means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately the girl got up and began to walk, for she was about 12 years old. And immediately they were completely astounded, as you can imagine. This just doesn't happen. The reason that so many people say your hope is based on nothing is because these kinds of things are just so out of the ordinary that it would astound anybody that even heard about it. They would not believe it. It was unbelievable. But they saw it. And they saw the little girl. And she got up. And she began talking. Why does he mention that she's 12 years old? Some people will say, well, he wants to make a connection with the woman. She had a 12 years issue of the blood, and this girl was 12. And that's interesting, but, you know, I'm sure you could come up with stuff, but no connection is made there. But in case you thought this was an infant, let me tell you, she was 12. She got up and she started talking. And immediately they were all completely astounded. How could it be that this man actually has healed, not only has power, not only to heal, but to even call someone back from beyond the grave? Would you be astounded by that? No, I wouldn't be astounded. I think Jesus can do anything. Well, after reading all the New Testament, maybe or maybe not. But if you were there, even if you were a believer, this would be something astounding. This has not been seen before. And you think about this, verse 43, and he gave them strict order. What would you want to happen if you had seen something like that, or if you'd done something like that? If you'd seen something like that, what's the first thing you're going to tell everybody? You won't believe what I just saw. How could it be anything else? What would you want to talk about, what I just saw? But he gave them strict orders that no one should know about this. And he said that something should be given to her to eat. Jesus had a very specific mission. Yes, these things were important. Yes, these things were faith building. Yes, these things were guarantees of things to come. But don't go spreading the message too fast, because everything has a time and a place. In the moment, the adequate moment, the apt moment has not arrived for people to know about this yet. Throughout his ministry, he tells people, don't tell anybody about that. I healed this man, don't you tell anybody about that. I raised this girl, don't tell anybody about that. Demons are saying that he's the Son of God, don't tell anybody about that. There's a time and a place for everything. Why is that? Because he's on a grander mission. And the grander mission is, and you might say, well, I have no hope of him coming to my shore to heal me or to heal my family or heal anyone like that. I have no hope of touching his garment. Okay, fine. But do you have a hope of salvation? And which is greater? These things are a guarantee. These things are a shadow of the greater things to come. Why is my hope built on nothing less than Jesus' love and promises? Why is that? Because I've seen the things that he can do. And I've seen and I've estimated that he is a foundation that is worthy to build my house upon, as he says. Don't build your house upon sand. You better check that foundation. Now, any constructor that doesn't check the foundation to make sure it's worthy of building the building should be fired immediately and never work in the industry again. You've got to check the foundation. And what do you think? Is that just a once over? It looks kind of good to me. I don't know. It's level from here if I kind of bend a little bit. No, you've got to be thorough. I've got to make sure that I'm not on hoping, that I'm not just hoping against hope, and I've got really no evidence, but some of my arguments are really weak, but I'm just going to keep going. It'd be too embarrassing to turn back at this point. No, absolutely not. And that's what, to end, let's turn over to John. John 15. And let's see, I think think it's in the end here. John 15, yeah, it's in verse, I'm a little over time. I've gotten a little carried away here. Let's start in verse 18 and we'll end here. If the world hates you, you know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, because of this the world hates you. Remember the world, the word that I said to you, a slave is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they kept my word, they will keep yours also. But all these things they will do to you for my name's sake, because they do not know the one who sent me. If I had not come, now notice this verse. If I had not come and spoken to them, they would not have sinned. But now they have no excuse for their sin. He who hates me hates my Father also. We have proof. You examine the evidence. We don't have time. I'm sorry for going over, babbling on up here. We have evidence. We could go back to chapter 14 where he says, if you don't believe me because of my works, believe me because of the works that the Father has given me to do. That is to say, believe because there's something worth believing in. Not just because you're desperate. Not just because you're a pathetic, miserable soul wandering around in the darkness looking for any even semblance of light. No, believe because it's actually true. Examine the evidence. There's no fear. If you have the truth, there's no fear in saying examine the evidence. But if you think, well, maybe I'm not right, well, then there's going to be a lot of fear. No confidence, no faith, no with faith, but fear. So we believe, we have a hope, we've examined, some of us many, many years examined, and we've said, yes, this is a hope that is worth living for. This is a hope worth dying for. This is a hope that will not disappoint, but will take us to that eternal home in the sky. And it's all thanks to Jesus Christ. My hope is built on nothing less but Jesus' blood and promises. I'm sorry.